Welcome back, everyone, to ArtuCast number 161. The last episode we had was a good friend of mine, Oak Simpson. Oak and I were in the same year at uni together. I've not really actually interviewed many folk from my year. I don't know if he might be the first. I can't remember. But yeah, it was good to chat. We hadn't seen each other in ages. He was my age now then. He'd lived a life prior to uni, in the States and Australia. And then he's now sort of working as an agronomist. So it was really good to see him, really good to sort of hear the story and just, yeah, catch up, to be honest, which we're both pretty bad at doing. The next episode we'll have, which will be the next episode from now, number 162, is Cormac White. Cormac is another one of the Nuffield cohort, which I'm part of. Cormac's a vet, and his topic is on small ruminants. I can't remember the exact topic title, but we'll get into that next week. But today's guest is another one of that Nuffield cohort that I am in. I was really, yeah, it's good. It's been good to sort of catch up with folk on the podcast. Can't remember how many we've done so far. But yeah, you'd been in this WhatsApp group chat. We'd went down to Exeter. We'd got to know each other. But for the most part, it was so busy and it was quite hustly bustly, and there was hundreds of folk there. I really fully got chatting to folks, so it's been really fun to do this podcast and sort of get to hear everyone's stories and hear sort of what makes folk tick. Our guest today has got a really interesting Nuffield topic, which we will get into. But we'll introduce her first, and that guest is Liz Haynes. Liz, would you like to say hello?
Hello, hello everyone.
Just before we get started with another episode of the R2Cast, I would like to thank our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, formerly known as A-Plan Rural. Howden are heavily involved in the social media scene in the ag space with over 100,000 followers on Instagram. They use this following to host social media takeovers with farmers throughout the country to showcase their stories, as well as posting to their rural community blog with further articles about these people in the sector. On top of this, they like to support initiatives that are championing the British agricultural industry, such as myself. So thank you to Howden Rural for that. Yeah, as we said there, Liz, it's a good topic, and I think it would be strange to have a Nuffield topic that wasn't, in fairness. But I think yours, probably along with mine and a couple others, stand out away from what the sort of the normal topics are. I'm quite looking forward to talking about that. We'll get into that later, though. Could you give the viewers sort of a bit of background about yourself?
Sure. Hello, I'm Liz. I am a dairy farmer from Staffordshire. We milk about 400 spring calving cows. We're tenant farmers along with our two business partners. I'm a new entrant to farming, not really from a farming background, although my granddad was a dairy farmer, but my family are completely kind of shocked and surprised at the career path I've kind of ended up taking. It's been a surprise to me in a way, but 10 years in now, and it's going well. I think I've made the right choice. I also sit on the Sector Council for Dairy at AHDB. Been doing that since 2019. And for a while I was also a columnist for Farmers Weekly.
So quite a lot in there, quite a lot to unpack. It's
A
certainly
few different
something.
things, yeah. I
That's
like to
right.
keep busy, yeah.
Got your fingers in quite a lot of pies. We're quite good to speak about all of them. First off, I want to ask, why block calving?
It's all I've ever known. I can't really profess to know about any other systems of dairy farming in depth. Obviously, through my work with AHDB, I've learned a lot in the last 3 years about other kind of systems of dairy farming. But really, it's down to my husband. He also is a new entrant to farming, changed his career from being a surveyor to a dairy farmer, and always knew from the outset that block calving was what he wanted to do. He'd worked on a spring block calving farm kind of as a teenager, and through his years at uni, seen how successful block calving was on that farm, how it had kind of transformed that business, making the shift from being a kind of mixed farm with all year round calving and arable and sheep and lots of other things to just a really focused spring block calving farm. And so that was his kind of ambition to do that. And I guess also he saw the spring block calving and the kind of New Zealand system as a route for new entrants into dairy farming that was kind of more accessible. And he went to New Zealand for 18 months and managed a farm out there and, learned more about share farming and all those kind of things, and then brought that back to the UK. And so I guess that's kind of the journey that we've been on together, really, is moving from being employees to contract farming and now to having a tenancy, albeit in a joint venture with two other guys.
Excellent. And it's, you know, it's quite, with this podcast, we'll by very nature interviewed at least 161 people. We've had quite a lot with more than one person on. And
Wow.
it's quite common for a couple to have one person who's new to farming, but it's not uncommon for two to both not be. Was you guys at similar ages think of farming for me? I mean, or was there just random moments in both your individual lives that you're like, oh, I could
Well,
I
I suppose when I say that he's not from farming, he did grow up on a small holding and had some pedigree beef cows as a teenager, worked on this dairy farm from quite a young age, went to the RAC as it was then. So he was kind of more agricultural than me, whereas I was the kind of child who was terrified of like cows and dogs and horses, to be honest, and would prefer to be indoors with a book than outdoors kind of getting muddy. So yeah. It's fair to say it's probably been a bigger kind of shift for me than for him.
When for you was that stage where it went from want to be in books to, well, quite like this idea?
Well, I suppose so. We've been together a long time, and since even when I was at university, so even when I was kind of I studied English literature at university, so all through that period. We were together, and I kind of, as time went on, I guess I knew that I had to kind of make a decision because, you know, if I wanted to like stay living in London or something, then obviously that wasn't going to be compatible with his kind of farming ambitions. And I suppose for me, over time, I did kind of see, and through, you know, seeing what he did out in New Zealand, that this could create a business for us and an opportunity for us and a lifestyle for us. And so for me, it wasn't just about milking cows and rearing calves and that sort of things. It was about the business. I think that as much as the actual practical farming, the opportunity to kind of have our own business and be in control of our own destiny almost was what appealed to me actually. And so after uni, I went to work in London while he was in New Zealand. So I was there for a couple of years working for a couple of different book publishing companies, and I did really enjoy that. But equally, I'm the kind of person who's always kind of chomping at the bit, like wanting to run before I can walk in some ways or move on to the next thing. And in some ways, I was kind of frustrated because I was wanting to progress. Maybe I'm not a very natural employee in a way. I want to be the boss, I guess. And so when my husband came back from New Zealand, he then took a job on a farm in Dorset. And for a while, I carried on working in London and going to Dorset on the weekends. And then the kind of plan started to come together, and we bought some calves that we paid the business where he was working to rear them, along with the calves that were kind of in the herd there, and that was our kind of first foray into kind of having a bit of an investment, I suppose. And then a year later, I decided to give up my job in London and move to Dorset, and I went to work for the RNLI at that time, mainly because it was kind of, you know, when you kind of Google marketing jobs or whatever in Dorset, is one of the kind of larger organizations, I guess. And I loved working at the RNLI. Really fascinating charity to work for. Got to drive a lifeboat one time. That was pretty cool. Got to do the sea survival course that the lifeboat crew members do as well, because I had to write about that for the magazine. So I really enjoyed all that. And in the evenings, I was going to the agricultural college down there, Kingston Moorwood, and doing farm records and accounts with a view to kind of like skilling myself up, I suppose, for this plan of having our own business. And then after that was probably a year or so that I was doing that for, and then we saw this contract farming opportunity advertised in Shropshire and just decided to kind of take the plunge and apply to do that. And that was when I sort of became a full-time farmer as opposed to someone who just kind of played at it on weekends and evenings.
No more access to lifeboats.
Yeah, no. No, sadly not, but yeah.
I would just like to quickly interrupt the show for a minute to give you some extra information about our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, the new name for A Plan Rural. Howden Rural provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. Be sure to check out Howden Rural today. Liz, tell us about the tenancy process. I think, you know, I've had so many folk on here, and after planning, I would say getting a tenancy is one of the biggest challenges that folk come across. Yeah, tell us about that process.
So I guess in a way we were lucky because we came to this opportunity through our business partners who were already kind of in the running to have this tenancy. And so it was them that kind of flagged it up to us, and it was through them really that we got it. So we kind of owe it to our business partners more than ourselves in some ways that we've got this opportunity here. I have applied for tenancies in the past and not been successful, but been through that process. So yeah, completely understand how kind of difficult and stressful that process can be, and how, you know, it's a long process, isn't it? It's not like you know, applying for a job even or something. Often it, you know, the time that we applied for a tenancy, the process went on for months, and then we didn't get the tenancies, and you know, felt like you'd invested a lot of kind of time and money and emotion into it only to not be successful. And some people go through that, you know, numerous times before they get their tenancy. So yeah, I guess we were in the right place at the right time for this particular opportunity, really.
It was a was it a short process? Is that a long process?
I think basically our business partners had already been through the long process before we kind of came on board. So we kind of jumped the queue effectively. And yeah, so for us it actually wasn't, I mean, nothing's ever completely straightforward, is it? But no, it wasn't the same as that kind of process where you see it, you know, you see something advertised in the Farmers Weekly or something and submit your tender and all that. It wasn't quite like that. So
And do you have a duration on that tenancy or is it open-ended?
it's a 15-year FBT. So it's not the longest FBT. And we've built a new milking parlour here, and we've put concrete sleeper tracks down. We've laid a water system, you know, fenced it. So we've made some pretty big investments as well. So yeah, you know, there's quite a bit of skin in the game, shall we say? But yeah.
How far in are you so far? When was that? 2020.
We took the tenancy in April 2020, so right as COVID was kind of hitting. So that was an interesting year to kind of start a new business and try and build a milking parlor and things. So yeah, we're kind of like just over 3.5 years in. So it's quite scary how time kind of ticks away, and that clock on the 15 years is kind of counting down. But I think that's a good thing, though, to have some pressure on you and to be mindful of that. And maybe a mistake that I've made in the past is thinking that everything has to be kind of forever. And that, you know, I know on the one hand, I know farming is a long-term game and you can't, you know, make an investment and expect to kind of see that turned around very quickly. But on the other hand, life is long. There's lots of opportunities. You know, you never know quite what's around the corner. And so boxing yourself in too much, or you know, being too close to other possibilities, or thinking that you've just got one path that you can go down and that's it and it's fixed and final, that's not necessarily a helpful mentality either. So
You make a good point about life is long. I'm like you in that sense that I'm like, oh my God, if I haven't done everything by next Thursday, like my life over. Yeah, it's I don't know if that's a trait of a certain type of person, but yeah, I'm
I
like.
think it is. I definitely think it is. For me, it's definitely, it is a bit of an ADHD trait in me. I think a bit that thing of trying to like run before you can walk. And the way my brain works is it's kind of like everything is either now or never. You know, like
Yeah.
structure, having like a structured concept of time from now until the distant future is kind of hard for me. And that's something I've only realized in recent years quite that's how I kind of perceive things. And that's been a bit of an interesting perspective shift, I guess.
Yeah, I am. I think the best way to explain that an objective example is that, you know, I film these podcasts, obviously. And for about, I don't know, 6 month period when I went to 8 a month, I was like, well, I have to film 8 in 3 days and then the month's done. That's just not how it goes. Like, it needs to be
No.
compartmentalized, but I really had to change that over time, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's interesting. And moving on, you mentioned AHDB. Obviously, a very important organization. Could you tell us about your role with them, please?
Yeah, so I am a sector council member. It was originally called a board member when I first joined, but now it's a sector council member. And I suppose my role is to kind of sit on that board and represent farmer levy payers represent the views of former levy payers to AHDB to make sure that the decisions that are being made at AHDB are in the best interests of dairy farmers, but also then to reflect back out to levy payers what's going on at AHDB and hopefully make sure they feel in the loop and supported and keep a finger on the pulse, I guess, so that the work that's being done is relevant and meets farmers' needs.
Do you have
That's the aim.
contact? Do you have contact with farmers in that sense, or are you speaking to?
Yeah, I'm out and about at farmer meetings, at discussion groups, at those kind of things, industry events representing AHDB.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. And when did you start that? Sorry.
2019, but prior to that, they ran a program called Calf to Calving, and they had monitor farms around the UK who tracked 10 calves, I think it was, from birth to weaning. And we would record weights and things. And then we'd have these quarterly meetings on the farm. So we were a host farm for Calf to Calving in Shropshire. We'd have a quarterly meeting. We'd kind of track the progress of the calves. And then there'd be a speaker about a topic that was kind of relevant to that stage of development in the cow or heifer's life. And, really enjoyed that process, enjoyed the kind of farmer to farmer learning. Thought the project was really good, learned some really good stuff about heifer rearing through it. And so when I saw the advert then that they were looking for board members, I thought, yeah, like to get involved with this really.
And is there a term on that? Is there?
It's 3 year terms and you're allowed two, and then that's it. You're done. You can't do it again, kind of thing.
You're
So I
retired.
am sort of halfway through my second term, I suppose. Yeah.
Brilliant. I can just like picturing you getting to the end of that 3 year, I guess 6 year term in some ways, and being like, well, I've got nothing to do. What's the next thing I'm going to take on?
Yeah, it's true. Yep.
And did you say you write for Farmers Weekly?
I did for about 7 years write an opinion column for Farmers Weekly. Yeah, which that was a really enjoyable thing to do because I guess my previous background is more kind of like writing and books and things. So for me, that was quite a nice way to kind of keep a hand in with that kind of thing. So yeah.
Keep the creative juices flowing.
Yeah.
Was that like a monthly thing, or was that
I think it was every 4 or 5 weeks, yeah,
right?
which came round surprisingly quickly, to be honest. Yeah.
You're like, oh, it's ages away, and then suddenly, oh God, I've got to
Yeah.
come back next
And like when I first started doing it, I'd kind of meticulously plan them. I'd like think about my topic in advance. And then obviously as time goes on, it kind of you run out of ideas, to be honest. But you kind of get in the knack of doing it, and suddenly that format of writing sort of 400 or 500 words becomes quite a well-oiled process, and it's kind of easier to do it. So yeah.
think we were talking about that a wee bit at Nuffield thing. I was sat next to Rachel, who from memory has got a PhD, and speaking to Annie and whatnot, and they we were all saying, and I'm guessing given what you've just said, 5,000 words for a Nuffield is quite short.
Yeah, it's manageable, isn't it? Like when you break it down, it's not hideous, to be honest. I mean, I'm sure for some people it totally depends. Like if you've done a PhD or something, then obviously it's probably going to be a walk in the park. Whereas I'm guess, I've known other Nuffield scholars who are completely not used to that kind of academic writing, and 5,000 words feels like an absolute mountain to climb. So, but yeah, I'm that side of it is not the part of it that stresses me out at all, to be honest. The only thing is, again, back to the running before you can walk, I feel like I'm already trying to kind of write it in my head and I haven't even been on a single kind of trip yet. So it's just like, well, slow down. Just like, go through the process. There's plenty of time. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I think in fairness, I've probably looked at Nuffield and thought, well, yeah, we'll just dive in, we'll go for it. We'll start writing it in my head and whatnot. And like you said, I mean, I think there's some folk that are looking at the 5,000 words and think it's massive. I think also just as difficult a task as folk that have written 100,000 words, it's gonna be hard to write only five. It's
Yeah.
a bigger
And
challenge.
that's another thing that I can kind of tend to is like verbal diarrhea.
Yeah.
At school and stuff, I'd definitely be the person who was like over the word limit and being told like keep it concise, Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, for sure. Just right. Yeah, what was
I'm
it?
the person who can write like a whole page in one paragraph with like, one full stop or something. Yeah, so everyone's gonna look forward to reading that.
What's it? Waffling. Yeah, I was always called a waffler. I was quite bad for that. But yeah, we've mentioned your Nuffield a couple of times now, Liz. Can you tell us sort of what it is? What is your topic?
So the topic is neurodiversity in agriculture, which is out there. I don't think it's a topic that's really been addressed in a field before, or very much in agriculture before in this country anyway. So that's why I'm kind of keen to dive in and see what I can find out, really.
I think I've mentioned a couple of times over the last four or five episodes when I've talking this episode's coming. It was supposed to be a bit earlier, but my fault, couldn't film last week. So I've mentioned it a couple of times. And I think neurodiversity is the best word to happen to any sector in so long. I mean, we looked at, and even up until 2 and 3 years ago, mental disability, which is such a demeaning term, first off. And to take that back to like my parents' generation and stuff, some people that have a genuine talent, in some cases, would be looked down upon as stupid or whatever. And that's insane to me. And I get that years ago things were different and whatnot, but to look forward to in my time as a student, and I'm only 26, that was still the case. Mental disability, I mean, neurodiversity was not a word when I was at uni, not at all. And I would say, well, it might have been a word, but I was never aware of it in my
I think
full.
the word was coined in 1998, which, that's within our lifetime, isn't it? Or
Sure.
that's when it kind of entered like the academic kind of sphere. And then obviously it takes time for things to kind of progress from that academic kind of realm into the real world. So I think that is definitely something that's only kind of happening now, really. So yeah, absolutely. What you're saying is true, 100%.
Yeah, and it's been great. I mean, we see students that that have various neurodiversities, and we're now able to work with that in a good way to bring out so many skills that we're seeing. But what I think, just before we get into your topic particular, I guess made you aware of Nuffield, and why did you go down the Nuffield route as opposed to, for example, a PhD?
So I've known various Nuffield scholars kind of through my time in farming. The farmer that I mentioned that my husband worked for kind of through his teenage years, he was a Nuffield scholar. So we'd seen, what an amazing experience it was for him. And then I'm in a grazing discussion group that has a few Nuffield scholars in it, including David Taverner from our kind of cohort's dad. So I know him pretty well through my discussion group. So I'd kind of been aware of it through that, heard people talking about it, saying what a great kind of opportunity it had been for them, how it had had such a big impact on their lives. And I'd always kind of thought, well, I'd love to do that because I'm not someone who's traveled massively. I've been on, trips and holidays and stuff, but I've never like had a gap year even or anything like that. So, the opportunity to travel is amazing, but also I am someone who does enjoy research and writing and those kind of things. So it felt like it kind of would be a good fit for me, really.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite similar to myself, in fairness. It's quite, there's a lot of people I'd met. I think I'd probably met a lot of people that are Nuffield scholars but never realised. And then the more I sort of spoke about it, when I spoke about that I was going for it, the more I was aware of these people and thought there's a common sort of progressiveness about you people,
Yeah, absolutely.
which is quite refreshing. And why did you choose your topic?
So I have first been aware of neurodiversity because of my career before farming. So after uni, I went to work for a book publisher called Jessica Kingsley Publishers, who were pretty famous for their work, particularly on autism. I think they were kind of one of the first book publishers in the UK to publish books written by people with autism and for people with autism rather than just kind of medical texts. And they published a lot of health and social care and psychology and all those kind of things. But my job particularly focused on marketing the autism book list. So that was where I first became aware of people like Temple Grandin, before I even knew really about her involvement in agriculture or livestock production. And really enjoyed that, found it fascinating, learning all about that really. And then last year I was diagnosed with ADHD myself, which was a bit of a revelation. And it's kind of strange almost that I hadn't realized, given that I had spent time moving in those kind of circles and reading those kind of books. But I think it just shows, like you say, how much the conversation has shifted, how much more awareness there is now. And particularly with women, I think the kind of symptoms or traits or whatever you want to call it manifest themselves a bit differently in women. And the conversation has definitely shifted there, certainly since, the things that I was reading and hearing in my time at JKP. And, all of that, I think, kind of came together and led to me having that kind of light bulb moment last year where I was like, maybe this actually fits me. And yeah, that's kind of where it's led me. And then with regard to Nuffield, I suppose, until that point, I'd always wanted to do a Nuffield scholarship, but never quite known what my topic would be. And I'd kind of toyed with ideas about things like lean management because I'd learned a bit about that when I worked at the RNLI because they were big into lean management. But I'm not really a technical kind of person, so a kind of technical Nuffield scholarship about something to do with livestock or soil or grass or something, that wasn't going to be my bag. Although the people management side and leadership and things like that really interests me, I didn't feel like I had an idea kind of crystallized that really said, yeah, go for it. And then suddenly this whole situation with the ADHD and everything, it's all kind of come together and felt like, yeah, this is actually a really interesting topic to take forward.
Yeah, brilliant. And first off, before I forget, Temple Grandin is one of the coolest people on the planet.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to, oh God, third year at uni, I think, we got a seminar from her at
Oh,
uni.
wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. Really cool.
Cool.
Yeah, just such a pioneer of so many things.
Absolutely. I mean, I would love to try and meet her as part of Nuffield. I've no idea whether that will be possible or not. But I mean, back in 2010, with my work, she was speaking at a conference in Wales, an autism conference, and we were there selling books and things. So I heard her speak at that conference, and I remember sitting in like the breakfast room at this hotel, like a few tables away from her, and being like a little bit in awe and whatever. And I, didn't speak to her or anything like that, but obviously I've read her books and things, and just been really fascinated by her story, really. So yeah, that would be a really cool thing if I do get the chance to meet her, but we'll see whether that happens or not.
Give me a message after this, and I think I know the person at SRUC who's in contact with her.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'll see if I do, and I'll let you know, obviously, if not.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, so did the diagnosis come as one, a shock, and two, did it help? Did it change things? I'm always interested a bit about diagnoses and actually what that does.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something even people in my family have kind of said this to me, like, oh, it's all very well, giving yourself a label, but what does that actually mean, or what does it change? And so yeah, that is an interesting point. And it wasn't probably a shock because I guess I'd got to the point where I'd put some pieces of the puzzle together and felt pretty strongly that this was, a good fit for some of the things that I was experiencing. I guess what was more of a shock was the fact that you hear so much in the media about how hard it is to get an NHS diagnosis and that it can take years and you can be on a waiting list. And basically, I went to see my GP about something else, but I thought I'll just bring, you can do the kind of online questionnaire or whatever you want, because the diagnosis is literally based around like a questionnaire and questions about your life history. It's not like they kind of do a brain scan and go, yeah, you've got it. And so I brought the questionnaire with me, and I'd read a book that was published by, my old workplace, a recent book, and gone through it with my highlighter and been like, oh, yep, that's me, that's me, that's me. Took that with me to the doctor, and I kind of thought, oh, is he going to like laugh at me, or is he going to go, oh, sorry, we don't kind of deal with that here? And he was just like, oh, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I'll take a photocopy of that. Yeah, I'll send you off for a referral. Yeah, you'll get an email, and hopefully someone will be in touch. Might take a while, but whatever. And 3 months later, I got my referral. Spoke to someone, albeit online. I think it was like an NHS referral to a private provider. But yeah, and it was just like straightforward, simple, 3 months later, kind of done. And I was kind of like, oh wow, like didn't quite expect it to be like that. But there we go.
That's positive to hear, in fairness, because you hear a lot of slow stories.
But then what I would say is that after that, the kind of follow-up is not great because, there's medication options you can try, or you could have cognitive behavior therapy, but the NHS don't allow you to have both. You have to pick one, even though the kind of research shows that a combination of both is probably optimal. And then if you do the CBT, you just get like a set allocated amount of, sessions, and it's just probably an online thing. And if you go down the medication route, you're just talking to someone on Zoom or whatever who doesn't really know you, doesn't, doesn't the NHS have allocated them like a short window of time to talk to you. And so in the end, I didn't really pursue any of that, and I've not really had any kind of further support. Not that, I don't want to sound like I'm like bleating on, oh, no one's like helped me, because I also realize that I am someone who is managing. It's not, don't get me wrong, it's not like really a big problem in my life. For me, it was more about just that wanting to understand myself better. So I suppose back to your question, it's been positive from that point of view that it's helped me to access information and just understand better why I do certain things the way I do, or why I think the way I do, or why I behave the way I do. So back to that thing of, is it helpful to label people? Well, yes and no. If having that label kind of opens a door to some information that is useful to you that you wouldn't have otherwise had, great. But on the other hand, if that label is, going to bring stigma or negative, associations with it, then obviously that's not so great. But yeah.
The future of that shouldn't be the question of a stigma or negativity, though. You know
No.
that's probably what you're doing. That's probably what this is all about.
Hopefully, completely. And I think back to that term, neurodiversity, that's what I love about it, because we are all neurodiverse. The word literally means kind of the diversity of brains or ways of thinking. And, everyone is completely different. And yet there are some people that's ways of thinking, fit particular patterns that happen to fall under a certain label, whether that's dyslexia or autism or ADHD or dyspraxia, dyscalculia, bipolar. There's a myriad of different things, but we're all in it together effectively, and we can all learn stuff from each other. And something that might be helpful to a person with autism in the workplace might equally be helpful to a neurotypical person. And we can all share those kind of lessons, I guess, about the interesting different ways our brains work. That's the angle that I'm hoping to kind of look at it from anyway.
The way I see it is, maybe this is wrong, and maybe this goes against medicine and whatever it is. I don't think anyone's neurotypical. I mean, what is that?
What is typical?
Who's
And that,
correct in inverted commas, you
and
know?
that is such a big question that, some of the books that I've been reading talk about how, that concept of what is typical is kind of like a white heteronormative, it's an establishment kind of thing that's been chosen by privileged people. And even the kind of diagnostic criteria for all of these different things have been, set up by certain people in certain societies and, from positions of power. And so it's helpful to challenge that, I guess. And again, that's hopefully what looking at things from a neurodiversity perspective allows us to do, is to kind of reframe it, instead of saying these are, medical conditions that need to be treated or fixed, or these are, deficits. Actually, they're just different ways of being, and we all have different ways of being, and none of them are necessarily better than others or worse than others. Sometimes they bring challenges or make things difficult in certain situations, but equally they bring massive strengths in other areas. And that's another part of it that I'm massively interested in looking at, is like, what are the different strengths, and what do they bring to agriculture, and how do they make our particular kind of workforce special and interesting. And
I think that's really interesting, because do we look at neurotypicality, that kind of the word, you know what I mean, whatever, put that sort of term on it? Is it just a brain as an entity in itself, or do you look at the cultural differences that that person's experienced? How much does that come into it? How much does education? It's so much more than just like that brain, that sort of brain with no idea of an environment sort of thing, just looking at the brain, how the synapses work. It's not just that. It's really interesting. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to sort of what comes of it. So let's speak about Nuffield itself then, Liz. You sort of said before, but what's your plan, and how do you, I don't mean the study plan, we spoke about that before, we're not quite at that stage, but yeah, how that's, you're looking for that to sort of pan out.
Yeah, so I mean, there's people doing some interesting things in the UK, but not that much. Like today, I've been on the phone to someone at the NFUS talking about their dyslexia project that was back in 2014. But I haven't really found anything else within agriculture in the UK like that. You know, there are care farms in the UK, and I want to look at this from all the different kind of angles of the spectrum. So whether that is, you know, at the one end you've got the kind of Richard Bransons of the world, or you know, the computer programming wizards, the Bill Gates, but at the other end you've got people who have got more, you know, more severe extremes of these neurodivergences, and agriculture is, you know, doing things in that sphere as well. So I'd love to go and visit some care farms. And then, so I'll probably start off in the UK. Oxford Farming Conference in January. The theme is diversity and inclusion. So I'll definitely be going along to that and seeing who I can meet and what kind of ideas I can pick up. And then I'd like to go to Ireland. Trinity, not Trinity College, UCD. I always get them mixed up. UCD in Dublin, not Trinity College, UCD. They have had a neurodiversity project there that was modelled on something that was done at Stanford University. So I'd like to go and find out about that, what they've done there. Chagas, which is a bit like Ireland's equivalent of AHDB. They had a year of diversity and inclusion, so I'd like to chat to them about what they've kind of done in the sphere. And then there's some other farmers that I kind of know in Ireland that are definitely outside the box thinkers, shall we say. So I'd like to go and chat to them and see what kind of contacts they've got and where that might lead me to. So definitely spend a bit of time in Ireland. And then the USA is probably where I'm hoping to spend the longest kind of stretch of my time, just because they were probably the pioneers in the kind of neurodiversity kind of sphere. I'd like to try and go to Colorado State University, which is where Temple Grandin is a professor. They have a neurodiversity chapter there. I'd like to find out about that. And then I'd like to go and see some neurodiversity hiring programs. Like within the tech sector, there's lots of, you know, the big kind of Silicon Valley type companies have autism hiring programs. So I would like to go and kind of look at some of those and see how that works. But on that front, I'm kind of conscious that sometimes that makes me a bit uneasy, the kind of the way that those things are kind of like, my God, these people can hyper focus, do you know what I mean? And it can almost come across a bit exploitative, maybe.
Yes,
I
yes,
don't know. Like
yes.
I'll be interested to see how that is kind of managed, and how they kind of find the balance between, you know, creating something that is an opportunity for neurodiverse people rather than an opportunity for the company to come kind of profit from their skills, if you know what I mean. So that'll be an interesting kind of dynamic to look at and explore.
I hope you've kicked your feet up and got comfy and enjoying another fantastic episode of the R2Cast with another really interesting guest. I would just like to quickly take another second to plug the sponsors of the show today, the Scottish Farmer, and I would strongly advise you to go out and pick one up this week and see even more of the fantastic people that are in our industry.
So yeah, and then Europe, there's an organization called Specialistern that is a autism kind of hiring company, I suppose. They kind of train autistic people for the workplace, and they also almost act like a recruitment agency almost, I guess, that place autistic people in all kinds of different businesses. But they do have some agricultural links with pig farms particularly, I think. So look into that a bit. So yeah, just see where these things kind of lead me and take me, really. But within agriculture itself, I haven't found a great deal, to be honest, of work been done so far. So it's going to be an interesting one.
I don't know if the person you're talking to at NFUS was Kirsty, but if not, I'll put you in touch with Kirsty. Kirsty's been on the podcast. Oh God, she was one of the absolute first. I think number 11 or 12. She's
Okay.
10. She was the 10th. Yeah, right back in that sort of starting bit where Kirsty was a year above me at uni, and she struggled with reports, but. She was good at reports, but she couldn't work out what was wrong. And then she was diagnosed with dyslexia and sort
Okay.
of was fine. And she made some pretty notable campaigns, farmer club based, you know, like the big place in London,
Yeah.
US, I believe, and she sort of joined on as a young ambassador for that. So yeah, I don't know if that would be of use, but can pass you on to her, and also a few
Yeah, absolutely would.
places trying to employ. I don't know what their exact policies are, but could sort of send you the place, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, also doesn't matter. I
That'd
like
be
your point
awesome.
about sort of like exploitative, because when you consider this sort of thing, you think everything's been done for the betterment of people in general. But is there a stage where, and I don't want to say the word used, but the term can be used to better a company's sort of
Oh, I think
public
there's
image?
definitely companies like, in the kind of shiny corporate sphere that it's, inclusion and diversity is like something you pay lip service to, maybe, and it's about, ticking a box and making yourself look like you're on trend. And, that's also not at all the angle that I wanted to come at this from.
When you mentioned about Oxford Farming Conference, you mentioned sort of inclusivity and diversity. Do you this is a complete question that I don't know the answer to, and I don't think anyone apart from OFC will. Do you think when they say that, they mean, I just think when I hear diversity and inclusion in
To be
particular,
fair, I might have
that
actually added the word inclusion. I think it is something like the
diversity.
power of diversity, and I think it is supposed to be looking at diversity in all of its different kind of facets. A really broad definition of diversity rather than the kind of inclusion and diversity HR speak kind of inclusion and diversity. So that should be good
Yeah,
because.
I think that was probably the question, because I mean I think a lot of people hear that and think from an ethnic, cultural, and maybe sort of LGBTQ perspective. I'd never even considered neurodiversity perspective. So yeah, someone that's probably quite involved in this sort of thing never considered it. So it's useful to
You know, and I mean, like farming has AgRespect is the kind of charity or organization that's to do with like sexual and gender diversity within farming. And we've got mental health charities now that have kind of really shifted the conversation on that. But yeah, you're right. Neurodiversity just is one that hasn't really had its moment yet. So
It's certainly a word that, like we spoke about this earlier, but probably didn't mention this part, that I'm very much aware of it now and interested in trying to look into it so I can help people that, I don't like saying have neurodiversity, help neurodiverse people that, especially in my job, students I'm with. But a lot of people still aren't aware of it. So it's good that we're getting the word out there, and people like you are doing that. So that was UK, Ireland, US, and where was the place in Europe? Was that Switzerland? It sounded Swiss, but.
It's Danish is the kind of
Yes.
headquarters of the company, but I think they've grown to kind of all over Europe and globally now. So, yeah.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward. I'm actually, do you know, I've read a couple of Nuffield reports. I read Michael Blanche's and that's terrible. Jenna Ross's, I believe. But I actually think over the course of a bit of time, I plan on reading all of ours. I'm not going to read every single one from now on, but it'll be quite interesting just to have had the chat with you all and sort of seen where it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
All sounds good. All sounds good. How long do you plan going to States for?
Hopefully at least 3 or 4 weeks, but obviously for me with the farm and my children are fairly young, so it's just being a bit mindful of all those different things, but I'm hoping summer next year.
Yeah,
Grab a
you
window
are.
and make that's the great thing about the Springbok calving is things are a bit hectic in March when we have to go to the CSC in
Yeah.
Brazil. But after that, once mating is done in kind of May, June time, summertime is not as farms go, summertime is a relatively kind of chill time of year. So that'll be a good time to get the traveling in. So yeah.
Tell us about that quickly, Liz. I mean, let's try and forget the stress of the fact calving's gone at home. Are you excited for Brazil?
Massively excited because it's just somewhere that I'd never get the chance to go under any other kind of circumstances. So yeah, just like what an amazing opportunity. And I think we've just been lucky, haven't we? Because obviously the CSC kind of moves around, and so sometimes it's in Europe or whatever, and we've just lucked out that it's in Brazil for us. So
Yeah,
cool.
I
Although
think.
the itinerary is pretty scary. It's like planned down to the minute. I'm starting to learn how Nuffield kind of how Nuffield rolls. And there's everything from like a gala dinner to the opportunity to go horse riding to, like farm tours. So packing is going to be interesting.
Actually, you make a good point. I wouldn't have even considered that. Yeah, good point. I think as you're starting to learn, especially when I'm doing something like that, like I post about everything. I just want to say about a culture and explain what I'm experiencing in a culture. So I think people are going to unfollow me. I think it's going to be
No,
that much.
I love it.
You're absolutely right though about the chance of getting to go there. I mean, I think up the previous CSCs, Brazil or Zimbabwe would be my absolute favorite. I mean, Brazil fascinated me as a football fan for so long as well, but I did feel quite bad speaking to an Nuffield scholar over the week, Alistair, and I generally felt quite bad when speaking about CSCs, like where are you going, Brazil? And I was like, oh, I can't wait, all this sort of stuff. I was like, where did you guys go? Completely forgetting he was the COVID group, and they went to Norfolk, and I'm like, I feel bad, sort of.
Beautiful Norfolk. I've never been to Norfolk actually, so that would still be a nice, new experience for me. But yeah, not gonna lie, it wouldn't be quite Brazil, would it? So no
Any
offense to
positive
the
outlook?
lovely people of Norfolk, but yeah.
No, definitely. Here, Liz, it's always good to chat. It's good fun. Time sort of flies by. 3/4 of an hour has already flown by speaking about the plans for Nuffield. And as I said, very much looking forward to it. And again, probably won't see each other before March, but
No.
I don't know how this Parliament thing, I don't know what politics is, I don't know how it works. So I don't know how London will go, but very much looking forward to Brazil and seeing you all again. But before I let anyone go, there's two questions I ask absolutely everyone. And I hate the first one myself, but I'm going to say it anyway. The first one is, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I think you're probably quite good for answering the second question, which is, if you'd any advice for people new to farming, what would they be?
So in 5 years' time, well, I hope that we will have continued to kind of develop and evolve our business on the dairy farm. I guess my husband and I have an ambition to kind of have something in the pipeline for ourselves to give us a bit more kind of security for the future because of what we talked about, the kind of short length of the tenancy. And our business partners are fantastic, but equally, at some point we need to kind of have something a bit more secure just for us. So in 5 years' time, I'd like to be a bit further along the kind of pathway to having achieved that, I guess. And then advice for anyone coming in, just meet as many people as you can, learn from good people. I think that's something my husband was brilliant at doing is, he found out who were kind of good people doing good things in the industry. And to be fair, that, that guy in Cornwall that he worked for, the Nuffield Scholar, was a great person to kind of open those doors to him because as a Nuffield Scholar, he was the kind of person who was in contact with kind of progressive, interesting people. And so, we did used to spend our weekends and stuff visiting other people around the country and learning from them, basically. But then there comes a point that you just have to put in the graft and like save some money and make it happen basically.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No, very good. Very good. It's quite exciting. I always quite like when folk answer the sort of 5 years question. Essentially doing the same thing. Yeah, trying to do it better or trying to go further. But still basically means they're enjoying what they're doing. And also hopefully by then we'll be 3 years post presentation.
Yeah, crazy.
It's quite nice. I'll be Jock and I will be, well, given we get on time, we'll be presenting in our home nation, which would be quite nice.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's awesome.
Yeah. And
Cool.
and like you're saying about Norfolk, I've never been to Aberdeen, so
Oh, wow. There you
yeah,
go, then. Yeah.
never been north of Dundee. Well, I've been to Shetland. I've never been north of mainland Dundee.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no.
Well, I have got a confession. I've only ever been to Edinburgh and Glasgow. Those are the only two places in Scotland that I've ever been. So, yeah, will be new for me too.
Well, you'll have to experience the Isle of Arran sometime. That's where I'm from.
Awesome. Yeah, I would love to.
It's quite pretty, and if you do like a drink, the Arran Gold, which is basically the Arran version of Baileys, is to die
Ooh,
for. Yeah,
that does sound really good. I am a big Baileys fan. Yeah.
I haven't drank since June at all, but I think at Christmas I will enjoy one with my mum, a nice Arran
Yeah,
Gold.
that sounds like a good
Yeah.
plan. Yeah.
No, good stuff, Les. Listen, thank you for coming on. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure to sort of have a chat with another one of the group. And for those of you listening, hope you've enjoyed Liz's story. I'm sure quite a quite a topical one for some people, maybe a completely new concept for some people, and that's good that we're speaking about these things, and actually more people are becoming more and more aware, which is what Liz will be trying to do, and look forward to her report entirely. So yeah, I hope you've enjoyed that other episode. The next one coming up, as I've said, is with Cormac White. Cormac's another one of the Nuffield cohort. I'm not going to go into in depth because I can't remember exactly. I don't want to butcher it. Come back to the next episode of the R2Cast to find out. Thank you for listening to episode number 161, and we'll see you for the next one. See you then. I hope you've enjoyed another excellent episode of the R2Cast as much as I have, and I would just like to quickly thank our primary sponsors of the show today, Howden Rural, the new name for A-Plan Rural. If you follow Howden Rural on social media, you'll see the plethora of work that they do to support this sector, and it's been a pleasure to work alongside them so far, and long may it continue. For more information about them, be sure to check out howdeninsurance.co.uk/rural, and I'll see you for the next episode.